Welcome to the REORC Primary Review, where we cover the latest developments in high yield, distressed debt, and bankruptcy, and feature discussions on issues affecting distressed debt, leveraged finance, direct lending, high yield bonds, high yield municipals, covenants, private credit, and middle market companies. I'm David Zupkis. This week, Himani Trivedi, head of structured credit at Nuveen, joins REORC's Hugh Minch for a deep dive on investing in CLO equity. Trivedi discusses how CLO equity correlates with other asset classes within the leveraged finance universe and how different profiles of equity will perform in a range of future macroeconomic scenarios. And as always, we bring you our weekly summary of interesting developments in the restructuring world, as well as a preview of what's on tap for next week. We'd love to hear your feedback to help us improve the podcast experience, so please take a moment to complete the short survey at the link attached to this podcast and let us know how we're doing. It's Monday, March 4th.
Hello and welcome to the REORC Primary Review, where this week we're having a deep dive into CLO equity investing. CLO liability spreads have lurched tighter since the start of the year, leading to increased supply in the primary market as a more attractive equity arbitrage brings in third-party investors. That trend is a change from 2023, when an estimated 80% of new CLOs created were backed by equity funds controlled by an affiliate of the manager. But the arbitrage isn't everything. CLOs priced during 2022, when liabilities were issued at wide levels that caused the arbitrage to tighten, then enjoyed a pull-to-par effect as the loan market recovered its value last year, and that vintage is enjoying better returns in many instances than deals priced in 2021, when the equity arbitrage on day one was better. So what makes a good CLO equity investment, and how will the current vintage of CLOs perform in a range of potential economic scenarios? Today, I'm joined by Himani Trivedi, head of structured credit at Nuveen, to discuss. Himani, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So how does CLO equity correlate with other asset classes within the fixed income universe in your experience?
Yeah, CLO equity has its own place within the credit spectrum. It is a way to take exposure to credit markets in a unique structure, non-mark-to-market structure that CLOs provide. And so what we have noticed is the performance of CLO equity is not relatively 100% correlated to all credit markets from a total return perspective over the long run. I would consider CLO equity as an all-weather investment and allows for optionality in different market conditions.
And how have you perceived the opportunity set for CLO equity over the last several years, let's say from the start of the pandemic onwards? What factors are you considering while making a CLO equity investment, and what's the upside for getting those decisions correct?
Yeah, CLO equity is a great way to diversify when you're investing in credit investments. If you think about the markets as they have moved over the last 3 years, like you mentioned, in 2020, the CLO, the loan market had traded down significantly. Any new CLO creation was being made at discounted prices in 2020. At that point in time, the existing CLOs had a non-mark-to-market structure around the investments in CLO equity. So they don't necessarily get affected when there is a pretty high market volatility from a investment perspective. What I mean by that is there is no forced selling for CLOs when the market moves around because of its non-mark-to-market nature, unlike some of the CDOs that we saw back in 2008-09. So they performed really well going through 2020. And coming out into 2021, the liability spreads tightened significantly as the credit markets tightened. And hence, the cash flows started looking really good for CLO equity returns. The component for CLO equity in general, from a total return perspective, there are two components. One is the loss given default within the portfolios and the cost of financing. So all in all, as long as the losses are minimal in the portfolio and the cash flows are running down to the equity, that equity CLO equity returns work out really well in these different market conditions.
Yes, one statistic that's always stood out to me is that the 2007 vintage of CLOs had the strongest returns in the history of the asset class. I know that the market is indicating that a hard landing has been avoided, but that assessment could prove to be incorrect, obviously. How would you see the performance of CLO equity impacted if there's a US recession versus a soft landing scenario, which is what appears to be being priced in?
Yeah, like I said, you know, CLO equities has two components of its performance. One is the loss given default, and the other is the financing cost of the structure. So for the existing CLOs where the financing cost is locked in, they have a great way to be able to monetize and or be opportunistic on the portfolio side. So if we do have a hard landing scenario in the credit markets, obviously defaults tend to rise in those markets, particularly in the levered loan space. However, because there is a panic in the markets, in those type of markets, there is a mark-to-market movement in the secondary market. So CLOs can be opportunistic in terms of picking up mispriced credits from the secondary market. On the other side, you know, if you have a portfolio that is exposed to higher defaults, riskier portfolio, then CLO equity will underperform. So it all depends on how the portfolio is constructed and managed in these deals, in these CLOs. And so in a hard landing scenario, you could see a bifurcation of performance based on manager portfolios and manager management of the underlying assets within these portfolios.
That's an interesting point about the bifurcation of performance. Is that what you saw in downturns previously, say the COVID downturn that we saw in 2020, or also the 2008 vintage of CLOs as well?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, in 2008-09, if you look back, CLOs have what they call over-collateralization test. Essentially, losses in the portfolio would trigger that test and divert distribution cash flow to the equity to deleverage these transactions. So if you look at the history of total return IRRs across the spectrum of managers, you could see, you know, a median of 14 to 15%, but the range was anywhere from 8% to 30 plus percent IRR as it came out of the crisis, because managers who were able to mitigate the risk and or be opportunistic came out to do much better in those market scenarios. Similarly, in 2020, you know, we saw a similar outcome coming out of that shorter period of time of market volatility, but we did see a bifurcation in performance coming out of that market scenario.
So the other macroeconomic factor that everyone's really concentrating on at the moment is interest rates. And there's two possible scenarios, I think. The first of all is that inflation remains elevated. We could see rates higher for longer. But secondly, you know, if that inflation data improves and there's a recession is avoided, there could even be rate cuts later in 2024. So what do you think is going to be the impact on CLO equity specifically in both of those scenarios?
Yeah, that's a good question. So if you think about CLO equity, the way it is structured, it's exposed to underlying assets with floating rate loans, and the financing for CLO equity is also floating rate liabilities. So net-net, on a direct exposure basis, there is a very minimal interest rate exposure on directly to CLO equity. However, if we think about what the indirect impact could be, that is the nuanced credit side of the equation, where, you know, your underlying loans, the issuers have floating rate liabilities. And so if the rates remain higher for longer, they do have a bit more constraint in their free cash flow. If that causes market, if the market is moving where it affects the credit profile, where consumer confidence reduces and discretionary spending is reduced, there is a bit of a double whammy effect on some of these credit, levered credits in particular. So that is the asset side, that is the effect that you see. However, because the cost of liability is locked in, you also see new loan formations with a higher spread in those market conditions, and hence the spread between assets and liabilities, returns higher free cash flow to CLO equity. So you could see a scenario where, you know, if the rates remain higher for longer, you know, credit profile is tighter, liquidity is tighter for underlying portfolio assets. But at the same time, if you have a good quality portfolio, you could benefit out of a higher free cash flow to equity. So it's a bit of a convexity trade for CLO equity in those market scenarios.
So we have already been living with higher interest rates for 2 years now, and it's obviously a market change from the decade prior. What impacts on CLO equity have we already been seeing as a result of those rate rises?
Yeah, so you are seeing a lot more, the loans on the loans or the issuers, because of the higher rates, you are seeing the credit metrics to be a bit more levered, and certain LBOs, aggressive LBO transactions that may have been put together a couple of years ago, they are going through a phase where there is a lack of liquidity. However, as the market, it also depends on capital market conditions. So for example, in 2023, the market's a bit more shut down as far as capital market activity went. Currently year to date, as we have seen the capital markets open up, that definitely increases the likelihood of access of liquidity for many of these credits. So, I think, this recession, expected recession has been factored in for about a year and a half. Issuers have been focused on maintaining liquidity on their companies, on their balance sheet, and access to liquidity as well. So you are seeing very good preparation from issuers to weather the storm going forward. However, if the rates remain higher for longer, some of the levered credits may need to have either a restructuring or, file for bankruptcy, as they would not be able to access enough liquidity to sustain. So you will potentially see a bit more higher defaults. The expectation in the market is anywhere from 2.5% to 3%, and some restructuring of these existing loans in that market scenario.
So going back to our market overview of where things are now, liability spreads have tightened sharply since the start of the year, especially at the AAA part of the capital structure. What are some of the dynamics driving that, do you think?
Yeah, so the financing cost / liability cost is a factor of a few things, right? One is the appetite for risk, credit risk, which, based on expectations of rates reducing, the market has opened up this year to come back and invest either cash or reallocate any liquidity that they have in CLOs as an attractive asset class. CLOs, by the way, is almost $1 trillion market now, so it's no longer a niche asset class. It's a bit more mainstream, where investors are looking for relative value opportunities. Second, because the rates trajectory is not very well projected, meaning it could be higher for longer, or rate cuts could take either this year or next year, investors like floating rate asset class. So CLO, again, CLO liabilities fall really well within their portfolio as a diversifier. So you're seeing more investors coming in. As a factor of that, you're seeing the spreads on the CLO liability tranches tightening. They've tightened pretty significantly over the last 6 months or so, which again spurs the creation of CLO equity, which is why you're seeing third-party equity investors come in more this year, year-to-date, because the arbitrage is much more favorable, where you are locking in financing cost at tighter levels, and you can still potentially generate free cash flow to generate mid-teens type of IRR. The CLO structure being non-mark-to-market, you know, it can be long, you can be long volatility. That way the manager can take advantage of changing market conditions and also create alpha if the volatility picks up later in the year.
Yeah, and we've been looking into the amount of paydowns that AAA investors have been getting, especially at the two most recent payment dates. I think it was around $12 billion for both October and January. Do you think those investors are actually increasing the size of their books, or are they just maintaining their exposure where it already is?
It's both. Some investors are receiving new money to be deployed in the asset class. So we are going to continue to see more flow come in the asset class. By the way, the constituents of investors have also expanded from institutional investors to now retail investors recently, up and down the capital structure on rated side. So you're seeing new investors there. And you're right, there is a recycle component of existing CLOs. About 40% of CLOs are post-reinvestment, which means that they start amortizing. So as the AAAs get paid down, more cash comes into the system to invest in newer CLOs with cleaner collateral, newly ramped collateral, and investors like to invest in those type of investments from a longer term perspective.
And on the equity side, where you've already mentioned that you're seeing an increase in demand from third parties, how do you think the balance in the market between manager-controlled equity funds and third parties is shifting?
Yeah, that's a good question. So what we have seen over the last few years is more and more captive funds are coming to the market, and there are a few reasons for that. The manager sees what happens on the loan side, the credit market size on a real-time basis, and when they are managing a captive fund, they are able to be opportunistic with purchase of assets, timing of assets very quickly, given that the markets have been very dynamic. So the windows of opportunities to create a CLO have been really short. So manager funds have been pretty successful in 2022-23. For example, in 2022, we ourselves had done seven CLOs, buying loans at discounted prices in the secondary market, high quality loans. As we think about the arbitrage, which is the spread between assets, asset coupon, and liability cost of financing, when that expands, that's when we start seeing third-party CLO equity investors coming in. So you are seeing a mix of large managers having captive funds, either buying majority or up to 100% of their equity. And most recently, third-party equity has been coming in as a minority stake with some of these captive funds, or having direct control equity in a completely new CLO where the manager is not involved.
The other effect of tighter liabilities is that refis and resets have returned in a big way this year. A large number of deals have also been called. If you have an older vintage deal, how are you making that determination of whether to refi or reset the transaction or whether to call it?
That's right. So it again goes back to two sets of drivers in terms of thinking about total return to CLO equity. One is the financing cost and the difference between what your assets provide in terms of collection versus what your financing cost is in terms of distribution. So every time, you know, for existing CLOs, the question is always, what is the optionality remaining in the CLO? Either the assets need more time to recover, especially coming out of 22, 23 type of market condition, And if that's the case, there will be a situation where even when the financing cost is reasonable, a manager would extend the deal by resetting it to a longer period of time to gain the reinvestment horizon, restart that horizon for that portfolio. The second part would be where the financing cost in the market is much tighter than what your existing CLO has locked in. And CLOs provide what we call the convexity in the financing, which means when you are locking in a cost of financing, it's for the longer run, but it does have a non-call, 1 year or 2 year non-call optionality. So if you're past that non-call, you could refinance your liability stack to a tighter level if the market has tightened in. So that would increase the distribution to equity. So all in all, you are making those decisions of refi or a reset, depending upon whether you can monetize some of the optionality that is built in, and you know, either on the asset side to get a longer term value creation, or liability stack tightened in to be able to get more distribution to equity on an ongoing basis.
So there's a number of different metrics by which a CLO can be compared. Obviously, there's the portfolio spreads, there's ratings, there's deal vintage, and so on. What metrics are you looking at most to make investment decisions in CLO equity, given where the market is today?
Yeah, we look at underlying loss given default, potential for loss given default within the CLO portfolio itself on a name by name basis. I would say that is probably the most important driver for the performance, because like I said earlier, as we look into the future, we do expect bifurcation of total return within these portfolios based on the losses that could be materialized in these portfolios. So just to give you a sense, a 60 basis points of loss given default is equivalent to approximately 6% value to the equity, CLO equity, on a 10 times levered basis, right? So it is pretty levered to loss given default. The other thing that we look at is distribution to CLO equity. If you have a very tight cost of financing, you could continue to get the distribution for a longer run. So a combination of those two and running scenarios, you know, over a period of time is something that we focus on trying to find value. And quite honestly, when you have a fundamental view on the underlying assets, it gives you a bit of an edge to find those interesting opportunities in primary or secondary market from a CLO equity perspective.
So my final question is, how do you determine the optimal time to price a CLO, and how do you think the 2024 vintage will be perceived when we look back?
So I would say, generally speaking, we look at optionality in any CLO equity, whether it's primary or secondary, from a total return perspective. When we are looking at CLO equity, for example, in 2022, while the cost of financing was very high, we did print new CLOs where we bought assets from the secondary market at discounted prices. And the pull to par was the optionality that was on the asset side, while on the liability side, we did mostly 3-1, which is a 3-year reinvestment, 1-year non-call type of transactions. So at some point in time, you can refinance those liability spreads, which are much wider than what your historical spreads have been. And so that was the optionality component in 2022. In 2023, and now as we look forward, as the financing cost has tightened in, the optionality is in terms of having longer reinvestment period type of CLOs where you are buying good credit bottom-up assets, But at the same time, because these CLOs are non-mark-to-market, you are going long volatility. So in my mind, you are going to see 2024 to be one of those vintages where you have decent financing costs on an average on a longer term basis. But at the same time, you are clipping pretty decent spread on the assets for a good quality portfolio. And so, you know, going forward, if the market becomes volatile, you can capture value from mispricing or continue to get the good cash on cash distribution. So I think, as I said earlier, CLO equity is more of an all-weather investment and requires a very focused management of the portfolio and the structures. But I do expect it to do well. Like, you know, we have seen historically CLO equity has performed really well across different market conditions.
Himadi Trivedi, Head of Structured Credit at Nuveen. Thank you so much for joining the Real Prime Review. It's always excellent to hear your thoughts and your expertise on all things CLOs. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
For in-court coverage this week, we take a look at Thrasio, Diamond Sports Group, Rite Aid, Walgreens, Golair, Charismatic Brands, Genesis Global, and also the latest in the Judge David R. Jones Southern District of Texas scandal. Thrasio Holdings, an aggregator of third-party sellers and brands on the Amazon.com marketplace, filed Chapter 11 in a New Jersey bankruptcy court on Wednesday. The company signed a restructuring support agreement with 81% of first lien creditors who agreed to support a prearranged plan that would slash about $495 million of $855.2 million in Thrasio's funded debt and defer all interest payments in the first year post-emergence. Thrasio seeks $360 million in super senior secured debt financing to be backstopped by the ad hoc first lien group consisting of up to $90 million new money term loans and a roll-up of $270 million of term loans. Under the RSA, the new money DIP loans would convert to first-out take-back debt, while the roll-up portion would convert to second-out take-back debt. DIP claims would also be entitled to a DIP exit fee of 40% of new common stock on a pro-rata basis, subject to dilution by a management incentive plan. At an uncontested hearing on Monday, February 26, Judge Christopher Lopez approved the Diamond Sports Group debtors' $450 million DIP facility from junior funded debt holders and conditionally approved the debtors' $495 million litigation settlement with parent Sinclair Broadcast, former preferred note holder JP Morgan, and naming rights owner Bally's, subject to final documentation. Judge Lopez also approved the debtors' $150 million Amazon exit notes commitment. Approval of these three critical components of the debtor's restructuring support agreement with first lien lenders, second lien lenders, unsecured note holders, and the official community of unsecured creditors frees the debtors to focus on the negotiations of long-term agreements with their league and team broadcasting partners. DSG filed a proposed plan disclosure statement last week in line with the amended RSA. Last week, the Rite Aid debtors rescheduled the auction for their retail assets to a date to be determined, according to a notice filed with the bankruptcy court. The hearing on conditional approval of Rite Aid's disclosure statement was pushed to March 11th. Both the auction and DS hearing were previously slated for Thursday, February 29th. Ahead of the expected auction, Rurik published an analysis of a hypothetical purchase of Rite Aid's assets by Walgreens. Based on Rurik's analysis, Walgreens could purchase Rite Aid's retail assets at a price that would satisfy DIP and ABL claims, plus the market value of secured notes at a range of enterprise value to EBITDA multiples of 5.3x to 7.2x. If Walgreens' hypothetical bid would also need to satisfy potential settlement with opioid claimants, however, the multiple ranges would increase to 6.4x to 8.7x. At a hearing on Wednesday, Judge Martin Glenn approved on a final basis the Gold debtors' $1 billion new money DIP financing, during which Gold said that intense negotiations with aircraft lessors are starting to bear fruit. The hearing was uncontested after the debtors and DIP lenders struck a deal with the 2026 Ad Hoc Notes Group, allowing the note holders to participate in $50 million of DIP financing and granting them junior adequate protection liens on collateral consisting of the Smiles Loyalty Program assets. The Charismatic Brands debtors filed an initial Chapter 11 plan disclosure statement on Tuesday, reflecting the debtors' pre-petition RSA with the First Lien Ad Hoc Group, the Crossholder Ad Hoc Group, and Equity Sponsor Partners Group USA, Inc. The medical apparel distributor's RSA and toggle-style plan contemplates a dual-track process under which the debtors would sell the equity of the reorganized debtors or substantially all assets, or if the sale process fails to yield an actual bid, pivot to a debt equitization-based reorganization under which holders of first-party claims would receive 100% of pre-dilution reorganized equity. Last week, Judge Sean Lane presided over 3 days of trial in the confirmation hearings on Genesis Global's standalone no-deal litigation plan. The court concluded the evidentiary portion of the confirmation hearing and will hear closing arguments on March 18th. Genesis Parents Digital Currency Group and an ad hoc group of crypto creditors continue to oppose confirmation, with DCG arguing that the plan's proposal to value certain customer claims as the distribution date instead of dollarizing them on the basis of petition date prices would funnel billions of excess value to customers. The fallout from Judge David R. Jones' undisclosed relationship with Elizabeth Freeman, a one-time partner at Houston-based law firm Jackson Walker, continues to unfold, with a new civil RICO action filed against Jones and Freeman on Monday by Morton S. Bouchard III, the former CEO of Bouchard Transportation, an ocean-going barge company that sought bankruptcy protection in 2020. The complaint also names the defendants law firms Kirkland Ellis and Jackson Walker, Bouchard Transportation Advisor Portage Point Partners, and Portage Point Founding Partner Matthew Ray. Bouchard alleges that the Jones-Freeman-Jackson-Walker-Kirkland-Ellis enterprise used a secret relationship to oust him from his position as Bouchard Transportation CEO and bolster prestige and collect tens of millions of dollars or more in fees at the expense of those affected by the bankruptcies. Top Reddit stories this week included: McDermott plan sanctioned, judge criticizes Refikar's extraordinary conduct as fatal to arguments on discretion, relevant alternative, judge horrified by $152 million in advisor fees. Litigation coverage: acetaminophen MDL court grants summary judgment against plaintiffs in over 550 cases. High yield market takes breather during short week as investors wait for Fed's next move. Court dismisses Celgene CVR holder $6.4 billion amended securities fraud claims against BMS with prejudice. Finds latest complaint fails to address deficiencies in intent allegations. And now here's Kate Thomas in New York bringing you the week ahead.
Welcome to the week ahead. My name is Kate Thomas, and here are a few highlights from the upcoming week. A longer schedule of the week's events can be found under America's Week Ahead on the VIRA website. This week can be described in two words: Puerto Rico. Monday marks the start of the PREPA confirmation hearing, which is supposed to last through March 19th. The plan of adjustment is opposed by certain bondholders and unions and was rejected by 7 out of 14 voting classes. After voting closed, PREPA filed an amended plan with changes to the release, exculpation, and injunction provisions, which now include the Commonwealth as an exculpated party. The amended plan also includes revisions to the language regarding the treatment of Class 12 general unsecured claims. Non-consenting PREPA bondholder parties, Assured Guarantee, Golden Tree, Syncora, the PREPA Ad Hoc Group, and Bond Trustee U.S. Bank, who are poised to recover less than 3.5% of their asserted claims, oppose the plan on several grounds. A major bone of contention is the number of settlements reflected in the plan. The non-consenting bondholders say that the settlements allow PREPA to, quote, pick winners and losers among creditors having the same rights and payment priorities, unquote. The opposing bondholders accuse the Oversight Board of improperly buying votes from the settling creditors and have moved to disqualify votes of settling creditors whose classes voted to accept. Issue will be heard at the confirmation trial. Then on Wednesday, oral arguments in an appeal related to the issuance of almost $50 million in new bonds by the Debt Recovery Authority in connection with the qualifying modification of the Puerto Rico Public Finance Corp's debt under Title 6 of PROMESA are scheduled to be heard in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the First Circuit. In August, Judge Laura Taylor Swain ruled that the Fiscal Agency and Financial Advisory Authority and the Government Development Bank had authority to direct the Debt Recovery Authority to issue additional bonds. The Debt Recovery Authority objected to the bond issuance and appealed the court orders directing the DRA to issue the additional bonds. The bonds were ultimately issued in December. That's it for now. For more on the week ahead, including earnings reports, check out America's Week Ahead on the VIRA website and have a great week.
Thank you again for tuning in to the RIRC Primary Review and our weekly review. Find all our podcasts on the RIRC.com webinars and podcast page, as well as Spotify, iTunes, SoundCloud, and Amazon. Take care and see you all next week.